Everyone, don't forget to go to rerunnersafety.com to get yourself some cool ass merch. Get yourself sweatshirts, t-shirts, mugs, tote bags, and you can support us a little bit more. And the best of it is you wouldn't even know you're supporting a health and safety channel because it just looks cool, man. Don't forget, rerunnersafety.com. Get yourself some merch, peeps. Safe. What's up, guys? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety does exactly what it says on the tin. We're here to rebrand health and safety, challenge the perception, challenge those health and safety gone mad practices. And we do that on YouTube by providing free how-to videos. We do it on the podcast by providing free in-depth conversations as well with amazing people like today's guest. So today's guest is Robert Dukes. Robert is a young man that's absolutely shooting through his career in health and safety. He's fired right up to the top. And if you have anything to do with social media around safety or leadership or anything like that, this man is probably all up in your face. He's a networking genius. He just networks like mad. And he's absolutely thrown so much money at investing in himself. And frankly, just an interesting conversation as well. So we've got Rob on to just chat through Rebranding Safety. We're just going to talk about health and safety, talk about his career, talk about networking, and talk about all the things that are going on. And just have an amazing conversation with another health and safety professional. Hopefully this will provide some insight if you're coming into the career, if you're new into the career, if you're thinking about coming into health and safety, if you're a current safety professional. I think there is so much in this conversation that we cover that just an interesting chat. So without further ado, let's get into the podcast.
Health and safety is almost a victim of its own success.
Weird and oppressive regime of health and safety regulations.
A huge fire engulfs a tower block in London.
Children being forced to wear goggles to play conkers at school.
Worst oil field disaster, 164 dead.
Rebranding Safety, the modern health and safety podcast, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent and your host, James McPherson. Rob, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, no, thank you for having us. Look forward to it and hopefully it's not too scary.
No, I'm sure it won't be. Okay, Rob, why don't you give us an introduction to yourself? So just quickly, you're like a SHP rising star. You're pretty much coming out of like all social media orifices. You're absolutely everywhere. You've kind of come out of the blue on my LinkedIn as well, and now you're absolutely everywhere. So kind of let's just give us an introduction of like you, where you are, what you do, how you got to become a rising star, what even is a rising star, and then from there we'll just chew the fat about health and safety.
Yeah, as for what is a rising star, I don't know. Everyone keeps telling me that I'm doing well and that I'm going to be a rising star. So for me, I'm kind of see that as maybe someone that's going to develop them into becoming a big influence within the industry, which is ideal. That's what I'm aiming for. Whether I achieve it or not, well, maybe in a few years' time, I might be having another phone call and we'll be saying, yeah, you've done well, or we'll be saying, yeah, you kind of didn't hit the mark, really. find out. Who I am, I'm 27 years old. I'm health safety manager now for Wax Cervical. I've been there a year within about 20 sweet days away from me being there a year now. So I've done something well. Fantastic organisation. Really, supported us and helped us with masters. So things are going well. I won the Rising Star Award there.
How does the Rising Star come about? Do you get nominated? Do you have to apply? Or how does that come about?
I think there's an application process. I was fortunate that one of my former colleagues, from when I worked at BA Systems, I chatted quite a lot with him. And I think he's quite proud of what I was doing. So he kind of nominated me for the award. And that's where it came about, really. He liked a lot of what I was doing. The judges picked me. I think bit of the feedback that I had was that I worked night shift when we were putting on a new shift system. I was keen to work the new night shift to kind of see what the lighting was like on the night shift, see the effects that it has on the employees, and generally just see what the area is like during the night shift. And and make sure that we've done everything that we can to make it a safe working environment. So I think that went a long way with the judges. I think the fact that I spent a lot of money self-funding my courses, and, you know, the NEWAS General Cert, the Diploma, the Masters now, you know, Principal Project Manager's course, NEWAS course, we keep going on about NEWAS ones, but that's one that I've kind of just, I was first made aware of, and it's given me a good grounding within health and safety. Through to everything else, you know, I'm balancing working full-time as a HSC manager, part-time doing a Masters, doing the diploma at the same time. Don't ask, I laugh. That kind of just came about through opportunities, basically. You know, I'm involved in a few local charities, like the Keswick Barrow. So that's the charity walk from Keswick in the English Lake District through to Barrow and Furness, so it's 40 miles. Raises just short of 400,000 for local charities, national charities as well. Through to being involved in the local IOSH committee and the Environmental Resource Forum. So,
got your fingers in a hell of a lot of pies there, mate.
One of the things that I've been very keen is that when I was looking at, you know, growing and developing, everyone always said about networking, and we look at what a lot of top people in the industry are doing, and they're involved in multiple causes. You know, they're not only doing the head of health and safety or HSC director role, they're actually also involved in, you know, charity boards, you know, sector initiatives, industry initiatives, they're advising parliament. That to me is all the pretty cool stuff where you actually, you know, you're not only having an effect within your organisation, you're actually changing health and safety for the entire industry and as a whole. So that's kind of what I kind of see and what motivates me to kind of get to that them levels. But I think that everything you're involved in, if you're involved in a charity thing or involved in say you're involved in the Irish local Irish committee, you're getting up and speaking in front of, like, you know, 40 to 50 local peers at an Irish meeting. You're developing your public speaking skills. You're taking skills that you're developing in one area that'll help you in another area. So I definitely think that it's good to be involved in a lot of things and get a lot of different insights from people as well.
How did you get into safety? Did you start? I'm going to assume you didn't leave school and be like, "Mum, I'm going to be a safety professional." Do you know
what I mean? I think up until last year, I've never actually met anyone that through school knew they wanted to be a health safety professional. And then at the AOSH conference, this year, the Irish 19 conference, there was a student there that was, I think, 14 years old, that he wanted to be a health safety professional, which was fantastic to see. But traditionally, I think a lot of people don't know about health and safety as a career until, like, you know, they're in the world of work, and I think, oh, that's a pretty cool thing, I don't mind getting involved in that. And I was the same. I actually went to university. I studied a law degree, really enjoyed law. Due to personal reasons, in my third year, decided that I didn't want to go into the type of law that I wanted to do. So I looked into other things to do, moved down south with my girlfriend at the time, split with her, and then did what anyone in the local area does and looked at the shipyard, BA systems, and you applied for a job, got in there. And it was through working there that I actually I had an accident. I had a patch hit me, caused slip disc in my back. And speaking to the health safety professional that investigated that, he helped me get involved in health and safety. You know, we had a few things that we got on with. We both played for the local, same local rugby team. And yeah, he kind of helped me. And then, you know, I said, well, actually, I'm quite liking this. So, you know, there's a few things in my role that I could kind of do that were health safety related. I then thought, right, you know what, I'm going to self-fund the general cert, because he advised that's a good start. You know, I think there's no other options really in terms of, you know, the other courses at the time wouldn't really give me the same level of qualification that I could achieve locally, really. So I looked at the general service, it'd be a good start. So I took, I think it's 3 weeks off unpaid. So what the overtime shifts to pay for it. And yeah, I went and got the general service distinction. He helped me with vision on that. He helped me in terms of, you know, looking at any questions I had. And then turned around and said, right, well, I need to get some experience. I spoke to him about getting some. He couldn't arrange anything in work, so I went and asked, I think it was one of the senior managers after a meeting. He said, you know, we're wanting people to have this attitude, this this drive and be self-starters. So I went up to him after it, after his presentation, and went, Yeah, well, I'm trying to do that self-funded this. I'm looking at getting involved in safety. Is there anything you can kind of do? And he loved it. You know, he absolutely loved my attitude with it. And yeah, I was very fortunate that he arranged something that, you know, an internal work placement in the health and safety team. And from there, that's where I got more and more heavily involved. And then I got offered my first role. So I left the organisation to go to a firm called Sheep Island in UK. And yeah, that's my first health safety advisory role, really. Quality and environment were thrown in with it as well. So, you know, got you know, a lot of good, fantastic experience within quality as well and within environment. And that was a real challenge, really, because I went from an industry where, you know, yeah, you had to be on top of your game and you had a lot, you know, you had hundreds of people doing stuff like hot work, through to clashing different processes as well. So it was quite a high-risk environment there, but I was going to another high-risk environment, working on a construction site, specialised, so it was piling it. And one of the unique factors of that organisation was that they would only be on site for, 2 to 8 weeks at a time. So you'd have, like, you know, possibly 8 different sites kicking off. You'd have them all around the country, and then they would only be on site, you know, different sites for a few weeks at a time. So it definitely had unique risks that had to be, you know, controlled and monitored, really, in terms of, you know, a lot of these workers were working away from home and whatnot as well. So.
Wow. Have you always had that kind of, are you kind of naturally quite a driven person? Like, it must take some drive to be able to just, well, to be honest, there's not a lot of people like that self-fund qualifications, especially in our game. So that firstly is a big thing. And you know, I self-funded my diploma, and you know, these things are not cheap. So, was it born out of the passion from the incident, or was it a bit both? Or
I think it was a bit of both. I think when I decided I want to do something, then I'm going to go do it. At the same time, though, I think when I got kind of worked out, you know, that's what I wanted to do in my life. And after the accident, I got insight into it, and it really struck a chord personally. I think that was it. It kind of pushed us to go out there and achieve it. And it kind of made me realise that life can be quite short. You know, there's another incident that I had. I took the girlfriend to, when I was still working at BAE Systems, when I first met my girlfriend, we went away to Berlin for the Christmas markets, and we were actually involved in a guy drove through the market in a lorry, so the terrorist attack, and we were right there since all that unfolded, and obviously tried helping out in the aftermath of it and whatnot. But I think that between the two incidents happening in quite a short period of time, it really drove home to me the importance that life is quite short. So it's like, well, I see things that I want to go out and do this and achieve that, and I'll make the best effort I can to do that. I think that's kind of what motivates me, really, is to go out and achieve what I can.
I like that. Rugby union or rugby league you play?
I've played a bit of both. Prefer league, to be honest.
Prefer league?
Well, no. Yeah, prefer rugby league, yeah.
Gonna have to end the call there, sorry.
Look, I'm a big England rugby fan as well. In the World Cup, it was a shame about the final. But yeah, rugby league is traditionally, I was one of the rugby league heartlands there. So I grew up playing rugby league. I think the first time I ever played union, I got up after running through and breaking the line or whatever, got up and played the ball, and the referee was laughing that much, I don't think he could blow his whistle.
Well, did you do the old chicken scratch, did you, in the middle of a union?
Yeah, I basically got up and played the ball like you would in rugby league, and you don't do that in rugby union.
No, you really don't. Oh, that's cool, man.
I mean, so we're not killing the time when everyone's laughing at you.
Well, it would have been cool for us union lot to stand and watch. feel free to come over to union and play a real sport. You know, we don't really want to watch touch rugby, which is basically what league is.
Bit out of shape at the moment, Mike. I think that's nice. With that, I wanted to get back involved with trying to find balance of my life at the moment between working full time, university, and everything else. It can be quite hard at times, but yeah. I started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu recently.
Okay.
And you know, the first few months were brilliant. And then I got back, went back to university, like, you know, second year started, and I had to be up and down about three times now. So trying to find the right balance can be quite tough, but I think once I get my master's probably finished, and I've got more free time to do that. At the end of the day, it's a sacrifice for what I'll pay off later in my life. Although I do want to do a MBA or PhD, I keep saying, you know, I don't think after the master's is complete, we'll be finished doing courses and whatnot. There's still a lot of EBOSH courses that I'm kind of eyeing up as well. And one of the other things is I actually am quite interested in, believe it or not, the NCRQ route. You know, I think everyone keeps comparing the two. So for me, I, you know, I wouldn't mind actually doing both and actually saying, well, I've done both. This is what it is. But at the same time, I'm not, you know, the self-funding aspect of it, it will be something that would come later rather than sooner.
That's interesting. I don't know many people that would have done both, like both the same level. I mean, there's a lot of people that have done the general and then on the NCRQ they've done the diploma or something like that. I'd be interested. Let's stick on that route then. Let's have a chat about like NEBOSH and diplomas and NCRQs and there's so many, isn't there? I mean, you're saying there you're doing the degree route as well. Christmas started early. I've been drinking like every day for the last 5 days. I feel rough.
Brilliant.
No, it's not brilliant. I drank a lot, just like, you know, like when you drink a little bit, like every day, like two or three beers or something, and I'm just like, oh. This morning,
yeah. Well, if you feel lousy each day, don't you? Then that's a problem you have. It's
I like my beer. Don't get me wrong. I love a good ale and stuff like that. So Friday, Saturday, I'll have a couple of beers. But Christmas comes and I'm just like, get the beers in. I just feel rough now. I said to the wife this morning, I'm not drinking anything today other than water and orange juice. Anyway, so we got so many routes, and I think it'd be an interesting conversation because I remember a gentleman on LinkedIn a while ago, this was a few months back, he put a post on LinkedIn saying that basically, I kind of paraphrase what he says, or well, I've not even paraphrasing, I can't remember what he said, but it was along the lines of the NEBOSH is a higher standard qualification, the NCRQ is a cheaper, easier, quicker route, and that he, as an employer, would only employ somebody that had done a NEBOSH diploma, so we're talking degree level 6, over any other, because in his opinion, the NEBOSH would produce better safety professionals. Now, as a person that's done the NEBOSH General, the IEMA, which is the Institute of Management of Environment Association or something like that, I don't know.
Institute of Environmental Management Association, I think it is, okay.
I'm glad you're here. But it's very closely related to NEBOSH, like they're extremely similar, other than the fact that IEMA is open book. But notoriously both extremely difficult end of course exams to pass. So then you've got the degree level. Now, for me personally, my opinion is not that either produces a better safety professional than the other. What I think,
yeah,
I think it's all about learning styles. So
yeah,
from doing the NCRQ diploma, it's very much case study based. You read a case study, they ask you questions, then you learn around each different case study, which is normally an incident that's happened. Now, obviously, they use case studies in NEBOSH, but it's all based on coursework and work that you produce yourself. Kind of similar to the NBQ, but I've been told, I've never done the NBQ, so anyone listening, feel free to put in the comments and stuff about it. But like, I've been told it's very similar to like an apprenticeship style, like you work, you get stuff that you do at work and produce.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, yeah.
And then obviously you've done every other route by the sounds of it, of qualifications. so like, what's your, do you have an opinion? Do you think one is better than the other, or like for producing a better quality safety professional?
I think to say one qualification produces a better safety professional is very narrow-minded. I think it's wrong as well. I think generally you'll find safety professionals that have come through any of the routes, really, that'll be fantastic. I think, you know, you've got to look at beyond the qualification and look at who the person is behind that, like the personality aspect. But I think the qualification route depends what people are doing with their life at that time. I think, you know, from an employment point of view, you know, if I was employing someone, I'd look at them and say, "Oh, you've gone down this route. Why did you go down that route?" And I'd be looking at understanding what the mindset was. You know, was it that you've got a wife and kids at home, you've self-funded them, you're working within the industry, and you've got maybe 5 years experience already. So you thought, "Well, I'll do the MVQ route because it'll be just proving what I'm doing," or the NTRQ route. Or it might be someone that said, "I said, well, I chose NEBOSH. Well, why did you choose NEBOSH?" And well, they've seen it in a lot of job adverts. And all right, fair enough, it makes sense. But I think you've got to go beyond the qualification to understand the professional. I think it'd be very narrow-minded to do that. That being said, one of the reasons why I actually actively encourage people to choose a NEBOSH route is because a lot of the job adverts out there, and this is not, I think it's some employers being quite ignorant to what's out there, is that they sometimes say NEBOSH qualified or must have NEBOSH, and it's like, well, yeah, there is two other options there, but you know, if I'm just starting off in the industry and I'm looking for a qualification that is going to get me noticed by these employers and going to get me into that interview, and I don't have loads of experience, then I'm going to go do the NEBOSH route because they're doing that. I feel that if I've got the NCRQ or the MVQ route, then I'm fighting an uphill battle with that employer to get into the interview. Now, it might not necessarily be a job that you'd want to stay there a long time, but you know, they might be very ignorant towards health and safety, but you know, you're still going to want, you know, people are still going to want to get a start and get that experience. So sometimes you've got to take a sacrifice in the role that you want to get where you want to get, be in 5-10 years time. So I think there's wider discussion there in terms of what the which one's best for which person. But again, I think to something like that would be very, very harsh and very unfair. As much as I am a big NEBOSH fan, and that's purely because I've sat it and I quite enjoyed it. I think, you know, you got to look at the wider aspects of someone's life and where they are and what they're doing. And I mean, for money as well, you know, if you're self-funding a course, you know, if one's cheaper than the other, then why are you not going to go for the cheapest course? Mm-hmm. You know, I've paid probably, you know, tens of thousands of pounds in courses. And one of the things that I'm going to turn around and say is that, you know, I've worked within, you know, some major organisations. I've worked with some small organisations. I've worked with in different sectors, and I've spoken to many, you know, people that are high up in the industry or you consider high up in the industry. And I think there's people that do stuff and there's people that aren't. And that's simple as it is. It doesn't matter what qualification you have or what experience you have. There's people that will go ahead and they'll do what they say they're going to do. And there's people that will give you all the talk and all that. And in 2 years' time, they'll still be talking about it. And you're going, well, in that time, I've done this and this. So, you know, that's my kind of way I see it, really. But whether that's right or wrong, I don't know.
I agree with you. And I think they seem to, qualifications in general seem to hold so much weight. And I think it's disproportionate weight. I think, and this is just my opinion, this is just literally just my opinion and a few people that I might have chatted to on my travels, but we seem to, especially in our industry, have forgotten experience. Like, experience just doesn't seem to matter anymore. And it's like, you know, back when I was, you know, when I say when I was young, I'm not that old, but like, you know, when I was younger, it was like experience is the thing you need. And I remember that because I remember being at a young age trying to get jobs and being like, well, how are you ever going to get experience if every job wants experience? And I remember saying that to my mates. But now it's like, you won't even get your foot in the door if you don't have a diploma. And I understand that to a point, but it's like, there's got to be a point where you say, okay, fair enough, you haven't got a diploma, but you've got 15 years experience, for example.
Yeah.
Does that matter? You know, it's like, what you're asking for, what, one piece of paper? So if you've got, say, like 15, let's say like an average experience level for a management job is like 5+ years. So let's say you've got 10 years experience. You've got double the amount they're requiring, right? Double the amount of experience. And they go, you haven't got a diploma, so we can't employ you. But I've got 10 years experience. So yeah, but it doesn't matter. We want the diploma. Right, so I'll go and pay. I'll go and buy the diploma. I spend a year just smashing through three books to get a certificate, just regurgitating everything that I know just to get a certificate. Will you employ me? Yes. And it's like, really? I just think it really, I get why we do it. I get we need to evidence our experience or evidence our training, evidence on that qualifications hold a value 100%. I'm not saying get rid of them. What I'm saying is I think they hold a disproportionate value against people's skills, people's soft skills, which we'll probably come on to talk about, people's experience. You know, everyone talks about soft skills. You know, you see the job descriptions, job adverts, left, right, and center. It's important you have soft skills, blah, blah, blah. But we're not even going to talk to you if you don't have a diploma. So soft skills obviously aren't that much more important. And I find that they hold way too much weight.
I think soft skills is certainly something that's thrown around by a lot of people quite easily when you don't actually consider what, you know, how long it takes to develop soft skills. Because soft skills can take a lot more time to develop.
They vary by like personality, I think, as well. Some people can really, I'm naturally more of a soft skills based person. Like naturally I'm a talkative person. I like building relationships. I like engaging, love the sound of my own voice. So that's why I like being a trainer. Think, you know, influencing, relationship building, things like that. I love that. So naturally I'm drawn to that. I hate academic based stuff. Sitting down, reading law, reading case stuff. So it does depend on your personality as well. You know, some people, it sounds like you quite enjoy the learning side of things and building qualifications. So maybe that comes quite naturally to you. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, both really. You know, I think, you know, just want to just touch back a second on the soft skills. You know, it's always said you need technical skills and you do need technical skills. But if you don't know how to get across a message, you know, you don't know how to have that soft skill to communicate with people and drive home the message, then it's all on good knowing everything, but you're not going to pass it on to people and you're not going to have the effect in an organisation that they want. So that's why I think soft skills need to be considered as important. But in terms of I enjoy in learning the aspects of it. I enjoy learning new stuff all the time. But then I also enjoy speaking to people and actually finding out what the problem is. And I think one of the things that I always try to do is find a sensible solution and work with the various people or the various stakeholders to try and find something that balances everyone's needs and gets business going forward. I'm very keen to understand that some problems, they're not a quick fix. And the last thing that I always want to do was to stop work or to, you know, have a negative impact on the business, because I think as soon as you start doing that, then you start getting yourself pushed out of the circle, so to speak, in terms of, you know, a lot, you know, if you don't have positive interactions with health and safety, you don't push a positive message and you don't reach sensible conclusions, then you're going to find people are going to start doing stuff without telling you. You know, it's like the police approach. If you start trying to police health and safety and be very authoritarian and whatnot, then you're going to see people are going to be trying to get stuff done without seeing you. They're going to try do it behind your back, and you can't be everywhere at once. So I think stuff like that will happen if you start trying to stop work a lot of the time and start trying to put in place stuff that isn't practical. You need to make sure that the changes that you're making and what you're implementing is practical and it is actually addressing the need that you're trying to address. You know, I have seen some health and safety stuff be recommended or be implemented within certain organisations where you're looking at going, that doesn't even address the problem you're looking at properly. But I think that's where we as a profession need to encourage sensible solutions.
I think, you know what, I think you hit the nail on the head there when you're talking about that kind of police officer mentality. I've said that time and time again. You know, if you're not building relationships, which really is what this is all about, if you're not seen as a person that the business can go to for solutions, they're not going to come to you. And I say, like, yeah, sometimes, you know, I'm quite an honest person, and I've been on training courses and delivered training courses, and you know, been really honest with people about the company that we're working for and the positions of where we are. I remember having a lady come over to me and be like, I don't know how you still got a job when you're so honest about the business and the board and the poor positions that we're in. And I remember saying to this lady, like, you know, it might become a problem for me at one point. Somebody might pull me in a disciplinary meeting and be like, James, we can't have you telling people that the board don't really care about safety, which obviously I've not said, but that didn't occur. if I was to say to somebody on a training course, so, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do this, safety is so important, and then we don't do any of that stuff, then they lose trust in me. So then that one time that I turn up on their site or their building or wherever, and I say, well, Robert, you've got to stop doing that right now. This is some serious shit. Stop. They're not going to listen. And I need them to trust me, because last time we saw James, he said something and it never happened. So I've got no trust. I need them to trust me. And
it's that leadership credibility, isn't it?
Do you know what, mate? That's a much better way to put it. It is exactly that. It really is. And you've got to build those relationships. You've got to build trust, I think, is the biggest one. And you've got to... I remember working in manufacturing, we really struggled to get honest safety observations. And and I said, can I just play around with this? I was very young. I was very excited about having said I wanted to try it some new ways. I've read a load of books about Sydney Decker and safety differently. And I was starting to look at all these other ways of doing stuff. And I was thinking, oh, I'll just try something. And my boss was like, yeah, crack on, you know, it can't get any worse. So off you go. The situation where you're in was is that kind of observed behavior. So when you're observed, you act completely differently to as you act normally.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, I want to stop doing safety observations for a couple of months. So I want to let people forget about them. And then what I want to do is I want to go to the team leader and just not even mention the word safety observation. Just say, hey, do you mind if I just get taught how to learn work on the back of the line, like packing or something like that? Yeah, that's cool. So they taught me how to work on the back of the line for a couple of very specific painful orders that you needed a lot more people on. And then I said, right, I'm going to do a bit of a safety observation, but I'm going to work. So I'm going to come along and I'm going to help them pack boxes.
Yeah.
And then when the operator goes down to the back of the machine, I'm just say, hey, Bob, do you mind if I just come down with you? No clipboard, no paperwork, no nothing. Put it in my head, I remember it. Now, that's quite hard for some people, I get that. But you follow him down, you just have a conversation with him, and he, you know, what are you struggling here with Rob? What are your pains here? Do you know what? This machine, it's got this one big pipe here that engineering put in, and I have to duck every time. It's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we've got a problem. We found something, let's see if we come up with a solution. And it got to a point after a couple of months, we were getting emails saying, hey, we've got this really big order coming in. Do you want to do a safety observation? Because they weren't looking at it like a safety observation. They were looking at it like an extra pair of hands packing bubble wrap at the end of the line.
Yeah.
And it was just like, you've just changed that perception of it.
That's it. Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things that I have learned myself is to do something similar. So I was speaking to my boss about how we get people interacted more within health and safety. And a similar approach to what you're saying was that when I'm going down some of the lines and speaking to people, it's actually getting involved, you know, getting involved in tasks that they're doing and, you know, helping out with that and not actually doing an observation from standing there with a clipboard and watching. It's actually through interacting and doing that. And we found that we had so much more success with that kind of approach. You know, and another thing that I've done wherever I've went is just go speak to people and have an honest conversation with them about, you know, what they're struggling with at the moment, what's going on. You know, I remember once on site, I was talking to a few operators about the football, and I was staying at a hotel nearby to them. And yeah, that night we met up, we watched the football, had some food, and they were having one or two pints, and they were scared to get a pint when they were eating a meal with me. I said, look, if you're having one or two pints for your meal, that's not a problem. But, you know, if you're going to go have 10 pints and then go into work the next day, then obviously I'm going to be upset. But yeah, we had a conversation about what they do in the evenings and stuff like that. And that's one of the things where I thought, actually, you know, some of these are working away from home. What do we do to address that issue when they're working away from home and it's the evenings? You know, they're not, some of them don't want to go to the pub. you know, what they want to do is he wants to fill the nights, the bar. You know, there's only so much TV that they can watch, and you know, they're missing home, missing the kids, the wife, and whatnot. So we kind of had an idea about maybe having the kitty together, that, you know, to take a ball and all, to just get them doing something outside of what he would usually do.
I like that.
And I've noticed a lot of the principal contractors within construction now, a lot of the sites will have like five-a-side football leagues, or they'll have exercise classes, or they'll have different initiatives going on to get the team involved together. So you have people interacting that perhaps wouldn't necessarily interact, but you'd also have, you know, them all doing something that would potentially be fitness-wise, which would get them off the couch and would also get them, you know, away from, you know, drinking, say, fizzy pop or beer even. So I think we are seeing a lot more of this holistic approach, which is, you know, looking actually beyond just the tackling mental health, but tackling the wider health issues for employees. And I think you look back at a lot of organisations, I think it's actually the second coming, because the first time, I think, is when you look back at a lot of the Industrial Revolution, and there was a lot of football teams sprung up, you know, a lot of sports teams sprung up, even police teams used to have football. I think we're starting to see more and more companies actually go back to this approach of having, you know, football teams or having the initiatives go on. So hopefully that's kind of how, you know, hopefully we can do go towards that approach. But yeah, it's something that I kind of, you know, found that, and I couldn't believe it. A lot of organisations let them kind of fall by the wayside. But yeah, years ago, apparently, once, you know, factories used to have football teams and rugby teams and stuff like that. And yeah, I just can't believe it's something that's kind of, yeah, subsided almost.
Yeah, you're spot on. I mean, and just in a town close to me, Corby, they've got a huge football, like sports kind of group, where it's like football, rugby, and they're called SNL, so Corby SNL, and SNL stands for Stuart. Oh, I'm going to get this wrong now. I think it's Stuart and Lloyd, which are like the old, I believe, it's the old steel factory. They created a big football ground, they created a rugby club, and they're now bigger than, they're still going, they're bigger than the Corby, the actual Corby Town team. and it's just like, you're right, we used to do that stuff all the time. It's interesting when kind of what you just said, it's very similar to what Jason Anker said when he came on the podcast. That, like, we used to be so good at the social side of things. Like,
yeah,
if you think about it, you have like the cons club, the working man's club, you've got all these pubs and clubs, and granted it's all men's based, so we could do with being a bit more diverse there, but
oh, definitely, yeah.
But they've gone now. You know, you go into these clubs and they're just dead. There's just no one in there. So Jason was saying, like, we used to be so good at the social side. We've lost that. We go to work, we work, we finish at 5 o'clock, and we go to home. Some people go home to nothing. Some people go home to a totally different group of friends. But I mean, from my point of view, playing, I remember when I was working in manufacturing, we used to have like golf outings. So we used to all of us just go out, play golf. Like, it was a whole day off work, and the managers were like okay with it, as long as too many people weren't into it. Now luckily not everybody was into golf, or else we would have been screwed. But there was still a lot of us going and playing this golf day, and it was great. You had management mixed in with operators, you had team leaders from different shifts all working together, all playing golf. It didn't matter whether you're shit, whether you're great, it was a good laugh. We had a nice breakfast, we had lunch, and then we played another 9 holes, and then we went home. We had, you know, trophies and stuff like that. For me, as a safety professional, I remember I didn't play golf, but I went and brought some golf clubs, went down the driving range, because that was an opportunity for me to build relationships and
get
to know these people. And I think you're right. We've completely forgot that side of things. And I think if any business, anyone's listening to this, whether you're a safety professional, business owner, business leader, it doesn't matter. But, you know, can you do a bit more around that kind of social thing, building relationships and things like that? I think it's so valuable.
Definitely. I mean, the local sports club, it's now called Hawthorne Sports Park, well, it used to be Vickers Sports Club, and that actually stemmed from the shipyard. And, you know, they had everything. Football would be, they even had a shooting club at one point, bowls, all sorts. And then you go up to Ulverston, and I think it was Glaxo Sports Club. They had a sports club and a bar there, and again, had football and all these different sports going on. It just surprises me that a lot of organisations have now, you know, they don't understand that aspect. It's just like, you know, you talk about lost skills or lost knowledge sometimes, but that's actually a hope, you know, happened right across the board, that a lot of organisations have, you know, cut back, or they've, you know, tried to make the profit more leaner, to make more profit. But you look back and you think, actually, you know, sometimes the bit of goodwill that you create will, you know, create more profit because people will be willing to go above and beyond in the roles. And I've certainly found that what you put into something is what you get out. So the more you put into your employees and support them in not just the work aspects, but in the social aspects and in their personal aspects, and the more you will get out of the employer, so employees.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I remember having a conversation a while ago. I was trying to pitch to a business I was working for at the time to say, we basically had primarily digital based training. That was really all we did. We had the odd external trainer come in to our properties and deliver some training here and there, but it was very rare, mostly e-learning. And remember talking about this, we were basically just trying to make training and coaching, etc., and at different levels, so e-learning fit within this framework we were building, but we were trying to sell some physical training for some very specific things, but physical training externally delivered. So I would deliver it, but it was externally delivered. If we could get our properties and use it in our offices, and that's fine, but I would have loved to have been able to get more in hotels and things like that. And I remember the challenge back was, yeah, but why? We've got our own buildings, we can do it in our own buildings. It's because it's so much more than just delivering training. Is if you walk into this hotel, for example, and you look around as a delegate and you go, wow, this place is beautiful, or you're driving into the car park and you're like, wow, this must have cost a bomb. Doesn't matter if it cost a bomb or not. We could have got it on a dirt cheap deal. But as they walk in, they go, wow. And what happens? They feel invested in. They feel like that business cares, and they feel like I'm worth something. And they're driving it up. It does so much as a trainer. It puts them in a positive mindset straight away, which is for me, as a trainer is great. But once they're then more engaged in the training, they then learn more, they finish the training, they go back to work, they've had the training, they've understood, but also they feel like you've invested in them. And I think there is so much value in that. There's so much value in just, it's the silly little things I find. It's you know, going to a training course and you can go away with pens and stress balls and all this free shit, this free tap, really. That no one really cares about, but you just get this sense of investment. And some people say, oh, it's a load of rubbish, it doesn't really matter, people don't think like that. I do, personally. Yeah. I've been on courses. I remember my Nebosch course. It was a very, very, they've got a bit downhill for the last couple of months, but so I won't mention who they are, but the training center that we used were great. We went there and we had pub lunches. We basically got in a car and went to a local pub. There's like six or seven local village pubs, and had like this amazing food. And you were just like, do you know what? And I'll work my ass off for the next 2 years that I was there for that business, you know, because I felt invested in.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think some of the better training courses that I've been on, they've had, this sounds really, really daft, and you'll be surprised when I say it, but they were giving all the operatives tea and coffee and biscuits. Mm. It's such a simple thing to do. Mm. But I have been on the other aspect within an organisation when went on a course, and you know, you were having to put in, you know, put money in to get a cup of coffee that was like in a little plastic thing like that. And I was there going, well, you know, they're obviously just running through, this is just something that's running the mill thing. We're just trying to get people trained. You're not really bothered. But the difference in, you know, having you know, tea and coffee, which costs, you know, generally not next to an out, even for a multi-million pound or multi-billion pound organisation to train employees, tea and coffee does not cost, you know, it's not going to break the bank. If that's going to break the bank, then you probably need to look at your organisation as a whole, really, and think, you know, what's going on. But, you know, in terms of getting that value, though, like the difference between just, you know, just a normal cup, tea and coffee there for you, biscuits, you know, the entire approach is completely different, and you feel invested in. But then, you know, you put more effort not only in the course, but you come with the course thinking, yeah, I've had a really enjoyed that course. And then when you're speaking to all people in the organisation, you're going, oh yeah, I enjoyed that course, this is this and that, this happened, got to do this. And other people are going, oh, I'm looking forward to that course then.
Mm.
Or if it's not a mandatory course, you're going, oh, I might go on that myself, and I quite like that idea. But we've all probably heard as managers, when you've asked someone about something and they've turned around and said, oh, well, it's not that code, or it's this and that, what do you think, hang on a second, then why are we investing in that? Then it's not worth it. If they're telling you negative stuff straight away, you're thinking we need to change it. But the difference in a little small thing like that, the approach of that, really drives home. You know, they're coming out of that training session going, yeah, I really enjoyed it. This was positive. This was brilliant. And the tea and coffee art isn't necessarily going to change that. You know, it's a whole environment. You know, it's the room that you have. It's the little things like tea and coffee. It's the trainer. You make sure you've got an engaging trainer. I mean, you know, I can't count the number of times that I've had a trainer where they've just stood there, talked to me, and in the same monotone voice, and I've been there going, well, I'm going to read the book then or something. You know, to me, you know, you need to make sure you invest in the right training. You do pay for what you get. You know, some training courses you might see a training course for 200 quid or something, but then the other training course is the exact same course, but it's 300 quid. Well, why are you paying 300 quid? Why are you paying 200 quid? Well, the difference is when you come out of that 300 quid course, the employee is going to be a lot more, feel invested in, they're going to learn a lot more, the approach is going to be a lot better. Generally, I find, you know, you pay for what you get, whereas the £200 course, you're probably going to, you know, your success rate might be lower as well. That's another good thing, is to look at success rates. I've always seen that you look at success rates from some organisations, they'll publish, you know, the pass rate or something of, say, the NEBOSH, and they've got 97% pass rate for the NEBOSH general cert, and you're going, that's quite high, that. But then, you know, you're thinking, well, actually, your price matches that as well, so you pay for what you get. But if I'm going to put someone through that, or I want to pay for it myself, then I'm going to go for the deeper course.
Yeah, true. I think kind of what you're saying, like about the there's so much more to it than just the investment side of things. But I think you're so right, because there was a gentleman put on LinkedIn the other day, quite an interesting post, but it was more from a culture point of view, which essentially is what we're talking about here. Is you kind of
it's culture. Yeah, it's safety culture and company culture. Similar things are connected, but your safety culture is generally indicative of your wider company culture. Well, that's how I feel it is, and I think if you push safety culture right, it'll help push the culture within your organisation, which, you know, anyone that's in a managerial position would surely want.
I've always explained it like it's a business culture, so you've got a business culture, and that's it. So I always explain it like a pie. If you imagine you've got a pie or a pizza, for example, right? And each slice of the pizza is a different section of the business, where you've got your salary, you've got the attitude, how you're communicating, you've got feedback, you've got all this stuff in here. Health and safety is one of them. And you've got all these training, et cetera, competencies, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you could take one of those, let's say you're not very good at training, because we're talking about training, so let's say we're not very good at that. So you take that one slice of pizza and you throw it away, right? You've still got a pizza, so you've still got a business culture. You're just not very good at that one bit. You're missing that one bit of slice of the pie, for example. So what you need to do is kind of get that pie back, work on that bit of the pie, that bit of the pizza, and just focus on that one piece, that one slice, and put it back in. Or that one piece of the pizza is a bit shit, they've missed the toppings off, for example. So you could focus on that one bit, but you've still got that business culture. And essentially what this person was talking about was, ironically, he was talking about companies doing pizza Fridays and having bean bags in their offices, so people can, you know, like the kind of Google side of things, and you're looking at it. He was saying, like, that's all well and good, but actually it means fuck all if you're you know, overworking, underpaying, talking to people like shit, bullying them, all this stuff that goes on. You know, you've got no real bonuses or anything like that. It means nothing. It means absolutely nothing if you have a pizza Friday. And now I 100% agree with him. 100%.
I agree with that as well.
Exactly.
It's a bigger picture.
Yes, exactly. So I commented saying, look, 100% agree. A lot of businesses, they band around the word culture, especially in safety. We band that word culture around all the time. We don't think that there's so much to this. But the pizza Fridays, they still help. So if you're going to do them, then do them. That's fine. Start them, but you've got to work on the stuff underneath as well. And that's the same with this training stuff. You know, you can send somebody, and I think that's kind of what you were saying, but you can send a group to a really nice plush hotel, plush training ground, but if the trainer's shit, monotone voice, and it's just boring, and it's talking about section 2, line 4 of the health and safety, nobody cares, and that's it. You've wasted all that money now. I think that was similar to kind of what you were saying.
No, 100%. It's even bigger picture, it's thinking about the direction that you want to go and what the whole point of this is that you're doing. It's like you get caught up in the specifics and whatnot. You can get carried away in terms of, oh, like, they're doing that, we're going to do that. But actually, you got to understand why you're doing it. You got to go back to your main aim. What's your aim? Right, well, this is what we wanted to push. This is what we wanted to do. And making sure it all ties in to have that whole package that makes the employee feel invested in. Otherwise, if you book out a fancy hotel, like you say, and you do all this stuff, then, the trainer's not going to deliver the message that you want. It's like, well, lost the point of this. But, I think you're definitely right with that. And it's this thing that a lot of organisations struggle with. A lot of organisations go, like, we're going to improve the company culture, we're going to improve this, we're going to do something like Pizza Fridays, which is a great thing to do. If you do Pizza Fridays, I'm sure a lot of employees will be quite happy. If my organisation decides that they're going to buy us a pizza on Friday, more than happy for them to do that. but you've got to have the wider fit there. It's exactly what you say. So many organisations will get, they'll think, oh, Google's done this, or this organisation's done this, we're going to copy that idea, but yeah, but what's your bigger picture, though? It's got to tie in with your strategy of your organisation. You look at health and safety strategy, you've got to make sure that ties in with your company strategy. It's all right saying, oh, yeah, we're going to do this within health and safety, but then the rest of the company is going in the opposite direction. You're going to find yourself having a lot of clashes very well sooner or later at some point, and then you're going to find yourself fighting an uphill battle to try and get your agenda, to get people to spot your agenda if they're all moving in a different direction. I agree 100% with that.
Yeah. There is so much to it, but at the same time, like, I do genuinely think it's so simple sometimes. It's kind of like you're just trying to create a business where everybody wants to be, and that sounds crazy. And I remember talking about this with Devin, I think it was Devin Toner. We were talking about, he wrote a book called The Belonging Factor, creating a culture of belonging so people feel like they belong. I know, a challenge in being like, okay, well, what if someone's got like a shit job? So what if somebody, it's hard to say without offending people, but like somebody would think that they, a cleaner, for example, is not a great job, but some people genuinely love being a cleaner. Like, and there's nothing wrong with that. And frankly, the world needs people that love jobs like that, So some people look at a bin man and go, oh, I'd never do that. But some people just love being a bin man, and there's a sense of kind of service and things like that within it. And I said to him, well, how do you say, like, a multinational company, like a huge company where the CEO is so far removed from that cleaner, how do they create a sense of belonging that far down the line? And I remember him saying, like, it's not so much about getting him, the cleaner, to love cleaning. It's to love cleaning for that business. Love working for that business. And I was like, nailed it. What a good point that is. It's to create a business. I've got to spend 8 hours a day there every 5 days a week. It's like, I only spend 2 days at home, Saturday and Sunday, and some people don't even get that, with doing the things I love. So why should I not create a place where people want to be? Because at the end of the day, you can be like, well, that's all well and nice, Jane. It's all well and good, James. It sounds lovely. But like, I've got to get shit done. This product needs to go out the door. That's fair enough. But if you suck it up for the time being and create a place where I want to work, imagine how hard I'm going to work for you. I'm going to slog it for 8 hours.
That's it. You've got to find people who are more willing to put the hard work in and the effort in, and they're going to buy into it, and they're going to push it onto people. They're going to go out telling friends, oh, so I work for such a fantastic organisation. And I have friends that and I've done that myself. They turn around and say, I actually love working here. It's fantastic. And I've also been in jobs where I've worked somewhere and I've been like, I don't enjoy this. I can't wait to can't wait to find my next position. And you know, I know people that have been, you know, I know one or two of my friends that have told me about other organisations they've worked in, and you know, people are sat in toilets for, you know, I mean, I only met one person watching and sat in a toilet. You know, they went in with a big bag in the back, and the guy's like, "What the hell?" And you know, then at the end of the day, he sees the guy walk out of the toilet. He's been in there all day on it with a, you know, on a phone or with a newspaper or whatever, and he's like, "What?" And you're thinking, well, yeah, they've got no incentive to do what they do. They hate the organisation they work in, and that, you know, they're not getting pushed, they're not getting challenged, they're not got, for whatever reason. And you know, the horror stories that I've heard, a lot of people say stuff like that, is it's unbelievable. But you know, you go towards addressing that and say, well, you know, how do you make an organisation that people want to work in? Well, first off, you know, you actually look at the people as people. Not as someone that's doing a job. That's for me, it's as simple as, you know, treating people like people and looking at what would I need if I wanted to do that job. That's how I see it anyway. Whether that's right or wrong, you know, someone could come along and say, well, actually, you know, you're doing it wrong. But the way I see it is treat people as people and put yourself in them shoes and think, what would I want if I'm in them shoes?
Yeah, John, I think that's a great point. If somebody come, I think we're quite similar in the way we think about it. And I remember actually somebody actually telling me that the way that I think about business culture and safety and et cetera was wrong. That I think I'm of an opinion that we should have much less procedures and policies in a lot of the businesses that I've worked for over the years. I find we're very paper-based. So I was talking about it in this meeting. I said, right, James, the question was posed to me, James, if you were to imagine the ideal situation of where the business would be from a safety point of view, what would it be? And I was like, much less paperwork, much higher competencies. If I'm going to really bring it down into one simple sentence, there is so much more that goes into this, but I would want to upskill nearly everybody proportionately to their roles. And I would want to dramatically reduce the amount of instructions and procedures that we got. And I remember the challenge was, it won't work. I said, how do you know it won't work? And he said, well, because, you know, I used to work for this business that had a procedure for everything. It was amazing. You just knew what you needed to do. And I was like, do you want to explain what you mean? And she was like, yeah, so this company I work for, it had a procedure for everything, like making a cup of tea. And I was like, do you not know how to make a cup of tea then? And she was like, well, no, obviously I know how to make a cup of tea, so why do you need a procedure to tell you how to do it? Yeah, but that's just an example. Like, it just makes me feel more comfortable. Well, if it makes you feel comfortable, then there's a problem within the business. It makes you feel comfortable because it gives you something to blame, in my opinion. That if something goes wrong, you'll say, well, I followed the procedure, so it's a procedure's fault. I'd rather get you to a position where you feel confident in what you're doing because you're competent, because I've invested in you, because you've got support.
Yeah.
People like me as a professional, where you feel confident to make decisions, to go and do what you need to do, what we employed you to do. It's so funny that we employ people that are so-called like competent, technical, and then we get them in and we go, right, Rob, you know, you've spent years upgrading yourself, you've self-invested, you're really intelligent, we like what you're doing, we heard you on that podcast, Rebranding Safety, we really like your message, we want you to come over and work for us, be our manager. And you're like, yeah, or head of safety or whatever. And you're like, yeah. And then you get there, first day they're like, Rob, here's a load of procedures and that's how we want you to work.
I think you know, you never go, it's like, go back to the police approach quickly. You're never going to be everywhere at once, and you're never going to have a procedure for everything. You know, there's always going to be something that's going to crop up that either you don't have a procedure for, or it's going to go against your procedure. At the end of the day, I mean, I think if you look at there's a Chernobyl miniseries that I watched recently, and they say, well, that couldn't have happened in what they'd known. Well, it did happen, you know what I mean? Like, I remember looking at it thinking, oh, you know that's going on. And the guy's going, you know, I mean, I know that was obviously the way where the organisation was set up in the old Soviet Union and whatnot, but, you know, you're never going to, there's going to be times when the procedure's going to fail, or the procedure's not going to be perfect, or there's going to be something wrong. And that's where you need to have someone that's confident, that's going to make a decision. And I think some of the best organisations that I've had the privilege of you're working with or seeing or learning from is they put people in places where they make a decision on what they know, their experience, their skill set, and it might be to disregard the procedure at that point, but there's a reason for it. The reason, there's a good reason why they've made it on evidence, and that's the right decision to make. You know, sometimes you know you've got to do that. I think if you look at Grenfell, you know, look at what you're looking at that, right? The procedure was that you know, you stay in place and do an evacuation. But realistically, if you had someone that was in that position to say, hang on a second, we need to get people out of this building as quick as possible. Everyone, you know, those that can't escape, get down and get out, you know, would more people have survived? You know, if you had someone that was in that position, that was in leadership, that could have done that. And, you know, to me, I think you've got to give that authority to people that are in positions sometimes to come away from the procedure, to say, hang on a second, procedure's not going to work. Or, you know, it doesn't matter what organisation you're in, whether you're in a bigger, high-risk organisation, small-risk organisation, at some point you need a team leader or manager to lead and to do that. And they're going to have to make a decision that isn't, you know, that the procedure won't account for.
I 100% I think there is a value to it. And I think the problem with, you know, to kind of stick with the Grum, for example, I thought it's quite heavily in fire for the last couple of years. I particularly don't like talking about it because I think we don't know 100% of the story yet. But it's a good conversation. And I think the problem with it is it's a good example for both sides of the coin, really, because we had a procedure, we had a stay put evacuation procedure, and in theory it works 100%. So,
but then we go back to in theory though again all the time. Yep. In theory you could say communism's perfect, but in reality it's far, you know, it's worse, you know, potentially. So yeah, I think in theory and practicality can be quite different. A lot of times I have to agree with
I agree with what you're saying. So basically how it's supposed to work is it, and I'm going to teach you just like you probably know, but like it's all based on compartmentation. So each flat should be fire resistant box for 60 minutes. So in theory, still just stick with me, bear with me for a minute. So in theory, ideally a well-built, well-maintained, which is the key thing here, the maintenance of that building from what we've heard so far,
yeah,
purpose-built block of flats is the safest place you can be. Now, I remember watching that video, that news story about Grenfell live, and I remember this lady who just evacuated the building had managed to be collared by one of the journalists who were throwing loads of questions at the poor woman. And she was saying, I went into the stairwell, and now this was within 30 minutes of it starting. She'd gone into the stairwell and there was smoke. So much smoke that she couldn't see. Now that's like physically impossible if that building was made to standard with the smoke, with the smoke seals, the fire doors, etc. So the procedure works. Now I'm a massive supporter of some procedures. There should be some process and policies and procedures. The problem is we have too much. But the key thing I think with Grenfell, if you have something in place, if you have something in place, then it's got to work, and you need to test it, and you need to maintain the systems, the processes behind it to make sure that it works. The problem is we have too much of it that you can't see the wood for the trees because there's just procedures everywhere, and it's just crazy sometimes. And Grenfell is a good example for both sides of the coins where procedure should work, but didn't, and how we should empower the fire service to make a technical, very difficult decision. Because, you know, there's a lot of people talking about the fire service saying, well, they should have changed to a simultaneous evacuation. They should have got everybody out. But at what point do they make that decision? It's really hard. They have to, in my opinion, they have to go off the assumption that that building is maintained and suitable for stay put, because otherwise how do they fight the fire? Otherwise they might as well turn up and assume it's going to explode. That's an impossible situation for them.
I have 100% sympathy for the fire brigade in that situation, and that's what that's the fire brigade and the emergency services 100%. I think if anything, we you know, more people should support, you know, there should be more support for these organisations. You look at the funding going in, more funding needs to be given to our emergency services right throughout the country. That's not something that, you know, I want to shy away from. I want to say no. We as safety professionals should be saying, hang on, you know, there should be more funding to emergency services. You know, mm-hmm. say training and competency and this and that. We should be pushing for more funding for the a vital skill set that we need, vital services. But I think when you look at, you have your procedures in place, you have your practice procedures, you put them in place. But to me, you always need a competent, well trained, experienced manager or team leader to be in a position without processes to say, well, you know, these processes are working. Because at the end of the day, we audit processes to make sure they work. If we find they're not working, then we look at changing them. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, you need someone that understands their processes, understands what's going on. And, you know, they've got that wit about them to turn around and say, actually, you know, we need to deviate from the process. Or, you know, and I think, you know, you look at team leaders or you look at people that are in them roles, you know, and it's not a job that I think, you know, you can turn around and say, put anyone in. It's got to be someone that's got to have the right skill set and experience for that role, and they've got to have the knowledge of that. But I think sometimes you've got to have someone that's sort of turn around and say, well, I know that this is good. I definitely think this is going to fail, so I'm going to stop it before it gets worse. You know, if you find that a process has failed, you know, you do your checks and you find that process has failed, then, you know, do you want that person to carry on with the process regardless? And, you know, they're still doing the job, they're doing a good doing the process right, but then you end up with, say, a batch or something that's, you know, completely, you know, useless, or, you know, you're going ahead with a process that's going to create a hazard. You know, to me, I'd rather someone stop that at that point and say, actually, no, I think this is, you know, we need to do something else and deviate from the process.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's about making sure you have the right trained and competent person. You know, it's easier said than done. You get into that competencies of where procedure and where a trained, competent person managing that procedure, you know, changes. But, Yeah,
it's a huge subject, this, Grandfather. I think we've got so much more to come out. I mean, we got to remember that we're only on phase one of the inquiry now, so we've still got two phases to come out. And I do think we can all learn from this. I think building owners need to learn the most. I think they are an ultimate responsible person from this, and I think the fire service will be able to learn a hell of a lot. And I think it's a good thing that we can all learn from this industry. It's not a good thing it happened, but it's the inquiry, I mean, is a good thing that we can all learn from that. But I think we should.
It's an impossible task. It's impossible to know.
It really is.
You know, you're turning up to a building and you're assuming it's well maintained and it's got this, it's got that. It's impossible to put that onto the fire brigade, because the fire brigade are turning up, and to me, they do whatever they're doing is better than nothing, you know. So, you know, they're trying their best to get people alive, and you know, they go. These are people that are going into burning buildings. Let's remember that. Exactly. These are voluntarily going into a burning building to get someone out or to try and save someone. They're only doing the good, but at the same time, your information is key, and they don't have all that information to hand. You know, I mean, maybe there's something there to say, well, actually, buildings over a certain height or a certain occupancy should have electronic copy records that are submitted to the fire brigade every so often. I don't know the perfect solution.
There's a lot of conversations around stuff like that. A lot of conversations. You know, you've got some amazing systems, like I can't remember what it stands for, like BIM systems, which is basically a 3D digital layout.
BIM's Federal, that's pretty good.
Everything, and they look phenomenal. The stuff. The problem is, it costs a lot of money. But yeah, I mean, look, we'll move on from Grenfell before I end up getting in trouble. But it's I don't want to upset anyone. But it's a sensitive subject, but it is. It's an important one that we talk about, and I think we, the one last thing I would say from my point of view is that the inquiry is a good thing. We should all learn from this, but I do think what you just said was spot on. We have to remember the fire service are going into a flaming building when we're running out of it. We also have to remember that, you know, they've had their funding cut for so many years. You know, I don't want to get political or anything like that, but, you know, they've had their funding cut, their numbers have gone down left, right and centre.
We
have to remember that these people have been given, just like you hit the nail on the head, an impossible task.
Yeah.
So one thing that you are extremely good at, Rob, is networking. You are absolutely everywhere, like I said at the beginning of the podcast. So, and I will say, I will openly admit, other than this podcast, something I am extremely bad at is networking. So You're a big advocate of it. I know you're heavily involved in, you said about the environmental committee that you're on. I know you're heavily involved in your IOSH meetings as well, and you network it quite a lot. So I think from two points of view, as a safety professional, there's a huge power in it for yourself to get connections, but also to learn things. But I think there's a power in people who are not safety professionals networking with safety professionals to get free advice as well.
Yeah.
So why don't you just give us a kind of, let's imagine you're trying to sell networking to me. I'm bad at it. You're good at it. Mm. Advice would you give me to start networking, get better at it, what are the values of it, etc.?
I think it's probably a bit bad for me to say this, but I feel that it just comes naturally to me. I naturally want to speak to people. So, it's just natural that I want to develop these relationships. But I think, you know, when you're looking at trying to network, the biggest thing I can say is don't go looking to it like you want to meet someone, you want something out of something. To me, I always look at it as I actually want to get to know someone. I want to develop that relationship. I'm not really, you know, probably a bit naive this, but I'm not bothered as to what I can give someone or what they can give me. I just want to actually develop that relationship and actually get to know people. I think, I think that's the human aspect of it. And then, you know, once I get to know someone and, you know, I start thinking in my head, like, you know, how can I help them, or how can they help me? What can we kind of, you know, is there any way we can kind of develop some kind of relationship? Then it kind of comes to me, you know, actually, this person could probably help, you know, might be able to help with this, or they might be interested in this. This opportunity now, what's going on, or, you know, they might know someone that can help me with this. And then I start looking at, you know, how we can actually get involved in something once I get to know someone and see that, you know, where we actually get on, and be that actually, you know, we can both bring value to something there as well. You know, there's lots of people that I speak to that, you know, get on really well with, but realistically, we're not going to be able to, you know, we're not going to have opportunities from in different sectors. But at the same time, you know, I speak to someone that they're doing their sector, and I'm thinking, oh, that's quite a good idea, that I might have a look at that. And then it's like, oh, I've just your idea, I've looked at this. And I think for me, whether it's right or wrong, is about developing that relationship first. There are probably other people that come along and say, actually, you know, if someone isn't going to add value, then I'm just going to not speak to them. Well, I think that's very naive, because I think, you know, people, you know, you generally don't know what someone's involved in, what someone's doing. And, you know, someone could have an opportunity where actually you might spend 15 minutes speaking to someone one day, and, you know, 2 years later they have something I need for you, and they might say, oh, what's opportunity, what do you think? You know, I remember speaking to someone at a conference, and then, you know, I met someone else from the same company. I spoke to the owner of the company, then I spoke to one of the directors of the company. And then just the other day, one of the directors reached out to me and said, oh, a few of us within our organisation have, we spoke about, yeah, and we've got a company conference. Would you come and speak at our company conference? I'm like, yeah, oh, nice. I'll do that. And that's from networking. And you know, that actually came from nothing. That just came through me, you know, speaking to one or two people in the organisation, being very fortunate to speak to someone that is obviously high up in the organisation, well, the owner, and also one of the directors at another thing. And, yeah, one thing came to another, and it's just an opportunity that out of nowhere it's come up. So, I am a big fan of networking. You know, just through going to my local IOSH meetings, and explaining what I'm doing, what I'm wanting to do, you know, that I'd love to get involved in the committee. I've now been invited to join the committee. It's fantastic. And that was just through attending and telling someone what I want to do and what I'm doing. And, you know, we're after young people to come on board and to bring new ideas on, and to bring, you know, I think one of the things we're very keen on is to be looking at podcasts as well. So I have no idea what I'm doing with them, but you know, this is my second podcast now, so I might be scratching, you know, asking you for a few tips and whatnot. But it's something that they kind of they were kind of looking at doing, was making some of the IOSH committee stuff that they do, or some of the meetings that they do, can we put any of that onto an actual podcast to get it out there to younger generations? And I think that's a good thing to do, because it'll attract a lot of the younger generations that, you know, they're always involved in the phone, they're online on YouTube, and they're doing all like the podcasts themselves. You know, that's how they, a lot of them interact. So it should hopefully push health and safety into the next generation. So one of the things I've been very keen to do is to reach out on LinkedIn to people as well. I was very keen to, not going to mention any names here, but I met someone that was high up in the industry just through LinkedIn, and that person has actually now started mentoring me, and that's just through, you know, reaching out on LinkedIn, a few conversations, then, you know, I think I posted on someone's status on LinkedIn or someone's picture, he liked what I said, and then we actually got talking about that, just personally, and then I reached out about something else, and he reached out about something else to me, and now we've got a full-on mentoring relationship, and that came about out of nowhere. So yeah, I think, you know, you never know who you're speaking to on LinkedIn or in conferences, but, you know, look at developing that relationship, you know, even if you're not good at human interaction, or you're not good at, you don't feel confident speaking to strangers, just start off, like, you know, I think just start off to just pushing yourself a little bit, and I think it comes really handy when you go into a new organisation or when you're in a organisation and you're going around speaking to people. If you've been, you know, networking a lot of the time, or you've been speaking to strangers at conferences, or you've been speaking out to people on LinkedIn, you find it a lot easier to develop them relationships with people that, you know, are within your organisation that you wouldn't usually interact with. So I think it's definitely a soft skill that people don't necessarily invest a lot of time in, but with networking, definitely the amount of opportunities that have just come up to me just through speaking to people on LinkedIn, or you know, I think this podcast came about on LinkedIn. You know, we just spoke on LinkedIn, and, you know, it's something crazy. Whether I regret it or not, I don't know. Whether I've done good or whether I've done bad, I don't know. I might go and cry now. but yeah, you know, and another podcast as well with Richard Collins. So I don't want to advertise another podcast on here. You'll probably turn around and ban me from it now. That was another podcast that just came about through just networking people, you know, and I think there's so much that can be done in terms of opportunities. But then, you know, you're reaching out, you know, you're developing these relationships. You know, some people are going to be within an organisation, they're the only health and safety person within an organisation. You know, so you're going to want to bounce ideas with, you know, around with people. You're going to want to discuss stuff. You know, at the end of the day, you're still going to want advice and stuff and to get a second opinion. So in developing a relationship, you're developing a relationship where you've got that, you know, mentor, maybe not necessarily a mentoring connection, but you've got someone that you can actually go to with this and speak about this. And that's why I try to get involved in, you know, the IOSH group, and try to get involved in a lot of local stuff, is to have local connections where I can actually bounce ideas around that will understand the context and the area that I'm trying to bring something in with. So, yeah.
That was good, mate. That was spot on. Well done. You've sold networking to me. I think for me personally, I think it's just this is probably a very naive excuse, but it is more just time. You know, it's just trying to get the time to in the diary. And I think the other thing is I'm a tight bastard, if I'm honest. I don't pay for anything, so I go to anything that's free. But yeah, it's I think there's a value to it. I've just this last end of last year dipped my toe into the IOSH meeting, and I booked myself a couple of times to go over there. So I think part of my 2020 thing is to get talking to more people. It's good for me. It's good for the podcast. You know, I want to be telling people, yeah, you know, Rebrand and Safety, go and check it out. I don't mind you mentioning Richard's Safety podcast, spelled with an I, if anyone wants to go check it out. Because obviously you would have mentioned Rebrand and Safety on his podcast, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I did it on top of my head.
I'll go and listen to it and see if we cut it out. We're in a group, so there's a Podcast United WhatsApp group. So if it if he's cut it out, I'll say, yo, what are you cut out that for?
I can't remember something actually. What we'll do is, if I get very fortunate to go on, because I think he did say about potentially doing another one, if I do go on that, I will promise you 100% I will mention this podcast, and then what, you know, if he does cut it out, then you can kind of get him in, and we can kind of get him on the podcast, and we can ask him why he's cut it out.
Yeah, we could challenge him.
I could just see, you know, we get blacklisted from all these podcasts now. You and Richard both going, yeah, we don't want him on anymore now.
Nah, you'll be good.
I think with the AIOS thing, I think they've put a lot of effort into making the AIOS more safety practitioners. You know, you look at the new competencies that they've launched. You look at the AIOS Future Leaders program. I think that is massive. That I was fortunate to go this year. I'm probably going to upset AIOS here, but the AIOS Future Leaders conference I thought was more relevant to me as a health safety professional, becoming a future leader, than the AIOS 19 conference. You know, I thought this AIOS Future Leaders conference really, is more event. But no, I think really it was really good for anyone that is looking to be a future leader within health and safety. It really drove home the soft skills. It really drove home, in terms of mentoring. How you can get that mentoring relationship with mentoring work. Done a really good talk on that. That I wish. Well, if they haven't recorded that, then it's a bit of a shame. But I hope they have recorded that, and I hope it can be something that they can kind of put out there I think the Cameron Blake's second name now, but he really kind of wanted that relationship and really, really actually was very keen to get a mentoring relationship going, and he really went out of his way to do that. And I think that's something that can be encouraged towards anyone that's looking at, getting a mentor or getting the ear of someone that's high up in the industry. Should look out at reaching out to them and just get in touch with them and say, look, I'm a health safety, I'm just getting involved in health and safety. This is what I'm wanting to do. I think that you work for a company that I really admire. You've got you're doing a lot of similar stuff that I've noticed that I think you can help me grow these areas X, Y, and Z. This is what I'm doing. What do you think? And it might be that person might not be able to, they might not be able to help, but they might turn around and say, well, hang on a second. I can't help, but I know someone else that can help. Mm. And mm. I've been very fortunate that someone has done that to me. They turned around and said, actually, we're too far away to have a mental relationship, but I know someone that's closer by. And they put me in touch with them. And it's been phenomenal. But I think there's a lot there that can be, I think just reach out to people. Definitely. I think, at the end of the day, no one's going to come to you. I always got told years ago, no one's going to come to you and give you, £1 million. You've got to go out and earn it. You've got to go out there, seize opportunities, you've got to create opportunities and do that. And I think I've done that in terms of self-funding the courses. At the end of the day, if you're not going to get if your organisation isn't going to fund you on that course and you want to do that, self-fund it then. Do that. If it's to better your own life and your own career, do it. And then, if you're looking at mentoring or networking, then go meet people. People aren't going to come to you with an opportunity unless they know you. Unless they've known you, they've interacted with you, they know what you're doing, they know what you're wanting to do, then they're not going to think of you. Whereas if you've spoke to these people, they're going, oh, actually, I've got an opportunity here. Then they might, they're going to give you a bone. They're going to think, actually, I've got something here that I want someone to speak at a conference, or I've got something here. That person seemed keen. He seemed to have what I'm after. Right, I'll go for them. I think that networking is a dying art, I think, as well. I think you look back years ago and people used to have a very good, they used to write by letters, they used to interact a lot more. And I think, we touched on it earlier about how, the social aspect of jobs and careers are within a lot of organisations has kind of died off a little bit. And I think that's kind of happening with networking a little bit. You look back years ago and, I can't remember the last time I sent a letter, to be honest. But, it's lost art. By becoming increasingly connected, for some reason, people have this fear of reaching out to people that are high up in the industry because they think that they're not going to have time for them. When actually, generally, I think if I was in that position, someone reached out to me and said, oh, I think we know what you're doing quite well. What advice do you have to me? I'd be very flattered for that. I'd be like, oh, someone's actually seen that I'm doing something good and they want some advice. And I'd do my most to help them. And I have done when someone asked for that. But I say that now, when I'm in box by about 2,000 people, I'd be like, oh.
Free help, yeah. No, I think you're right. I think it kind of reminds me of a saying, like, don't ask, don't get. And, it kind of reminds me of, how we got Andrew Sharman on the podcast. You know, when I started this, did I ever think Andrew Sharman's going to come on my podcast? No, never, never. And I remember, I think I was watching like a Gary Vee video or something, and he was like, do you know what, just ask. If you want something, just ask for it, you know,
yeah.
And just see, they might turn around and say yes. Otherwise, they're going to turn around and say no, and then you're no different from where you are. So I remember, I can't remember if I shared I'd done a couple of book reviews of his stuff or something, and I did something, and I thought, should I tag him in when I share it? And I thought, fuck it, I'll do it. So I tagged him in it, and he commented on it, and he commented on something else previously, and I just kind of, the first time, just said, oh, thanks, you know, blah, 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 I really enjoyed the book or whatever. And the second time round, I said, thanks for commenting. We'd love to get you on the podcast, Rebrand and Safety, if you want to come along. We'd love to chat more about it. And he basically just wrote back and said, yeah. Cool, I'm up for it. Drop me a message. And then the whole time I was waiting for him to send me like an invoice of like $6,000 or something like that. I'd be like, yeah, I'll come on, but it's going to cost you this. And, you know, you just got to ask. And that was it. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, you know, we're chatting back and forth. We're getting the content kind of right. And just kind of, and then it was just a recorded Zoom call. No different from me and you chatting now. And you know what?
Yeah.
It comes from me asking. You're right. No one's going to give you what you want. You've got to go and get it. I think that's a great, great point.
I think the other thing I'd turn around and say is that there's only two things that in my eyes that you can control, and that's attitude and effort. And I think I've said this before. I say it to a lot of people that the more attitude, you know, you can control your attitude. So what you control how you're going to react to something or how you're going to be about something. And then your effort, you can control how much hard work you put in. You know, that's the only way I've got to where I am today is through, you know, having the right attitude and putting the effort in. And that's all I can recommend to people is them two things. You know, but if you sat there as a, you know, wanting to get into health and safety, or you wanting to get to that next step in health and safety, only you can do it. You know, only you can get your attitude in the right way. And also putting the effort. At the end of the day, it's going to take sacrifice. You know, you have to sacrifice a few things. You know what I mean? It's a given. You know, if you're going to complete a course, you're going to have to sacrifice money, time, and effort to actually do that. But that's the last things I'd really say is, yeah, and good luck to anyone out there who's looking at developing within health and safety. And if there's anything that I think either one of us can do to help, then I'm sure that we both would try to help anyone. So,
yeah. Yep, 100%. It messaged me, and I'll forward you on to Rob. 100%. I'm joking. I will help. It was a very good way to finish that. And, yeah, and I think you're right. And I think we can see the evidence in that at a young age, you know, a couple of years younger than me. And you know, you're flying through the industry. There's a lot of people talking about you. You're popping up everywhere on social media, mate. So 100%, you know, that kind of effort and attitude thing, I love it. And you can see that, you know, it's you can see it's working. 100%, keep it up.
Fantastic.
We'll definitely probably have you back. Depends on how your other podcast goes with Richard. I might go check that out. I think it's just come out.
It's just been released, yeah.
Yeah, just brought it out. So if you like Rob, you can go check him out on the Safety Podcast. Make sure that you come back over to Rebrand and Safety, though, after you've listened to
it. I want to see you and Richard on a podcast together. I think that'd be quite good.
Well, do you know what? That's something I've been trying to get for a while. I would love to see all of us podcasters, because it's about in the UK, and I think Richard's like in a little island somewhere off the side, if I remember rightly. but he 100%. I think it'd be amazing if we could get like myself, Richard. You've got he's going to kick my ass because I forgot his bloody name. You got the.
Edit in.
Yeah, you got the Interest in Safety Pod, that gentleman. You've just started the two guys, David Povin and somebody else, I think it was, that just started. They're not on our group yet, but they've just started the Safety of Work podcast. Then you've got Sunny Gopal, who's probably one of the OGs. He's like the original gangster of it all. He started his podcast years ago, I think. he puts more blog stuff out now, if I remember rightly. But you know, there's so much of us. We've all got our own different styles. You know, Richard's style is completely different to mine, and I like that. you know, I love that. I'd love to get some kind of event of us all just around the table, record that conversation, chew the fat, discuss the guests that we've had, our favorite guests and the things we learned, et cetera, like that. That would be phenomenal. And that's one of my dreams of Rebranding Safety, is be able to do an event like that. So you're 100% right.
That'd be brilliant.
I'd love to see us do it. Watch this space. One day I will get it to happen. One day. Okay, Rob, thank you very much. So we've recorded this on the 22nd of December, so belated Merry Christmas to everybody. I hope everyone had a happy, this will come out in the new year, so I hope everybody had a great Christmas and a new year. And you, Rob, I hope you have a lovely Christmas, and I hope you have a very prosperous new year.
Thank you, and you too.
I see you've got your Christmas jumper on already.
I have, yeah. I've got a family in the house like at the moment, so that's why I'm in somewhere else. You know, I think they've all got to open a few drinks now, and I was just kind of locked the back door and got out here, so that hopefully none of them will disturb me.
I'm sitting here a bit hungover from the last like 4 days of drinking alcohol, but I'm just sitting here thinking, really fancy a beer. So
that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go.
Right, mate.
We'll open one.
I'll let you
know. Don't think I'm in now till 6th of January now, so I think we're going to open a beer now, if I'm honest.
Okay, guys, I hope you found that useful, found it interesting, engaging. If you did, don't forget to hit like. If you're on YouTube, don't forget to hit subscribe. And if you're on Spotify, you can hit follow. There's so many buttons to hit nowadays. If you really, really like this podcast and listen on iTunes, we would really love a rate and review. Just helps us get into other people's ears via the algorithms and all these crazy things that go on nowadays. So if you do that, don't forget to screenshot it and tell us about it so we can shout you out on this podcast. You can contact us on any of the social medias, Twitter, Rebranded Safety. You can get us on Facebook, Rebranded Safety, on LinkedIn, me, James McPherson. If you listen on YouTube, watching on YouTube, all of those social medias are coming up on your screen right now. If you enjoyed this podcast as well, and you can think of three people that would enjoy it as well, share it with them. Let me entertain their ear holes. Share it with three people. Not everyone, don't need to judge everyone, I'm not greedy. Just three people you can think of, share it with them. We would love that. Thanks very much, guys. I'll catch you next week in next week's podcast. Safe.
Hey everyone, you're looking for something a little bit different for your next digital or physical conference, business event, safety event? How about Health and Safety's first and only YouTuber? Go to www.rebrandingsafety to get Rebranding Safety at your next event, or email me at james@rebrandingsafety.com. Catch you later. Safe.